You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Former hedge fund manager and well-known mining entrepreneur Mark Thompson joins us now to talk the commodities markets and various other interesting matters. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be on your show.
So, you've earned the epithet King of Tin from certain of the Twitterati who seem to think that you know a thing or two about the tin business. And I'm hoping to talk to you this morning about tin and a few other commodities too, perhaps copper, and maybe we'll stray onto uranium or anything else you're interested in. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what your view on the tin market is to kick things off?
Yeah, sure. No problem. Well, basically, you wait a lifetime for a market to be set up quite as well as we are set up on tin at the moment. And I say a lifetime, this is probably the second time in my career that we've had this level of setup, the first time being around 2004, 2005, when we came to the end of the humongous stockpile sell downs from accumulation of above ground stocks in between 1960 and 1985. When the tin price was down, I think in today's terms, around $3,500 a ton, we're currently at $34,000. And we really are now at a point, like so many metals, where the pipeline of new projects is pretty close to empty, and demand is growing considerably above long-term trend demand growth, and we have new uses in solar, we have new uses in sodium ion batteries, and I just simply don't see where the tons are going to come from to meet the market demand. And in that scenario, you know, economics 101 tells us that the only thing that will give is price.
So you and I were at a mining industry lunch, let's call it that, the other day together, and you talked at some length about Indonesia and the pivotal role that country plays in the tin market. Perhaps you could sort of recap a little bit of what you said then to our listeners and viewers today.
Yes, so Indonesia is the largest producing country historically over the last 40 years. Started really in the early to mid 1980s with discoveries of very, very large quantities of high grade offshore and onshore alluvial tin. So these are sheeted vein systems that have eroded in situ, and the tin has basically ended up deposit above bedrock. And is mined offshore by massive dredges, is mined onshore by both dredges and by suction pump operations and by shovel and truck operations as well. It's pretty low grade. Generally, it's between sort of 300 parts per million and 1,000 parts per million. But because it's basically clay hosted, you just have to pick it up, wash it, and then run it through a simple jig and shaking table to clean it up. So it's like we're talking $3-4 a ton processing costs for $5-20 a ton material. It's extremely remunerative. It's produced an awful lot of tin over the last 40 years. I think we peaked in the early 2000s at around 140,000 tons a year of production. Last year, they did 78,000 tons. And the biggest operator there was the state-owned company PT Timah. And what is going on of extreme interest to the tin market at the moment is there has been the most enormous corruption investigation from the Attorney General of Indonesia. And the numbers being bandied around are of the order of $26 billion of, should we say, missing profits, missing funds, of collaboration with illegal miners to work on PT Timah licenses, of tonnages going to illegal smelters, all sorts of shenanigans that have been going on for a very long time. A lot of people have been arrested, up to and including the chief executive and the chief financial officer of PT Timah. And this is just, I think, an extension of a policy that Indonesia's had over the last 10 years of trying to bring downstream value and reduce corruption in their primary mining and logging industries. And you've seen in copper that they've mandated that Freeport build a smelter because they wanted value add kept in Indonesia. You've seen this in aluminium, you've seen it in nickel. And tin's just the next one, and they're clearing out the Augean stables whilst they're doing this. So the most important thing that's come out of this from a tin market perspective is they've limited now the export licenses for 2024 to 44,000 tonnes. That's versus 78,000 tonnes last year. And this is in a 390,000 tonne market. So we're talking about 34,000 tonnes reduction, or give or take 8% of world tin supply. That's enormous. And normally speaking, that should be enough to treble, double or treble the tin price. And I think when you throw on top of that issues of Myanmar, where mining is currently, and it's very difficult to get good information, is currently suspended at the Mormore mining area, which was doing 30,000 tonnes a year of tin. We have two of the world's four biggest producers basically having significant cutbacks in production this year and an erosion of stocks. The price has already gone from 22 to 34. And I would strongly argue that if these bans continue, we're going to see tin above the all-time high at 50,000 and probably pushing twice that level within 18 months.
And would you say that that's likely to be a spike or a sort of longer-term outlook?
I've been a proponent for a long time that the prevailing tin price around 22, 25,000 was insufficient to incentivize the funding of new hard rock tin mines. And on the numbers, I was looking at 35 to 40,000 being the requirement for those financing packages to get put in place. I think you're going to see the banks wanting to see the tin price above that and considerably above that before they'll basically lend to a project on an assumption that 35,000 is the long-term price. So I think we need 50 to 60,000 for a couple of years. I think we'll spike above 100,000. We'll come back and settle between 35 and 60,000 or 40 and 60,000. Eventually. Well, that was my assumption until very recently, having just come back from the tin conference in Penang and been a little bit blindsided by something I wasn't aware of, which was the extent of the construction of new sodium iron battery gigafactories in China, which is going on. So why is that important to tin? Well, it's important to tin because tin turbocharges batteries. It basically, on the anode, it reduces massively the recharge time, thermal expansivity, a whole load of good things in terms of the mechanical engineering properties of building a battery. And there was a presentation there suggesting that if the full rollout of sodium ion batteries as grid extra storage, as in, you know, storing, you know, solar power during the day, releasing at night, would require 100,000 tons a year of tin by 2030. Again, I say this in a 400,000 tonne a year market. I mean, just tonnages that simply can't exist. So it probably lends me myself to think, well, does that actually mean that sodium ion tin batteries are going to get rolled out, or is it going to be more muted, or is it going to be price dependent? I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. I think the key thing to understand on tin is almost everything you use it for is pretty much 100% price inelastic. So it's going to be, again, fascinating to see which industries stop consuming tin as demand continues to grow. So, you know, if you've got a gram of tin in an iPhone, for example, currently worth 3.5 cents in a $1,000 item, there is no tin price where Apple stopped using tin on electronic solder in their printed circuit boards. If you've got, I don't know, 35 cents of tin in a washing machine in a $500 item, again, there's almost no tin price where washing machine manufacturers stop consuming tin on their printed circuit boards. If you look at specialty metals, you know, tin goes into sea brass, 40,000 tons a year. You know, what you use that for is almost unsubstitutable. If you look at tin cans, again, you know, the cost of tin in a tin can is a fraction of a cent. Again, what tin price before we stop buying cans of soup? There's things like the Pilkington process in making flat glass. So all flat glass is basically molten glass floated on molten tin in order to produce flat glass. There is no tin price where that is substitutable because there's nothing else that you can use. So it's a fascinating market, I think, from that perspective. It's, you know, it's akin to uranium in terms of there is no substitution, but there's going to have to be, because price is going to ration demand, in my view, in the coming years, because we haven't been looking. If you don't look, you don't find. You don't find, you don't build. If you don't build, eventually you run out. And we're in that sort of situation right now across multiple commodities.
And what sort of direction would you point investors who might be interested in getting exposure to tin in or towards?
There's a dearth of listed companies. So you've got a few producers, things like Andrada in Namibia, mining low-grade pegmatites. You've got the amazing BC deposit owned by Alphamin, listed in Canada in the DRC. They're mining 3.84% tin, but it is, you know, not quite in the middle of nowhere, but you can certainly see it from there. Very difficult, challenging operating environment, but a company and a deposit that I like very much. You've got Metals X in Tasmania, 50% owned, owner of the Renison mine, which has been going, I think, for about 1867, whatever that is, 157 years or something like that right now. It's got a few more puffs in that cigar left before this market rallies over. And then you've got a couple of the developers where I would always urge caution, because it's been such a backwater, there's very few decent management teams. There's a lot of assets out there that where either the mineralogy, the metallurgy, the permitting process, whatever, make them particularly challenging. But in that space, I own First Tin. That's my biggest tin position because I like that company very much. So I'll say I'm a shareholder in that. So just for full disclosure.
And do you have any insight into the Cornish activities that are currently underway?
I was down there a few weeks ago, very active in Cornwall myself and have been for a long time. When I was at Trafigura, we used to own a majority stake in the South Crofty mine before it got, through various subsequent transactions, passed on to the current owners at Cornish Metals. I am in no doubt at all that there are hundreds of thousands of tons of tin still at the bottom of that mine. It closed in 1997, not because it ran out of tin, but because the tin price was extremely low and just didn't have sufficient, it basically hit its cutoff grade, what they were mining when the tin price was $5,000-$6,000 a ton. I would imagine that their production costs and mine numbers would be around $12,000-$13,000 a ton. So it's a nice project. They're currently dewatering. They've done an amazing job in building the winding house. It's just fantastic. The dewatering is going incredibly well. I say I like the project very much, but like so many tin projects, the risk is really where the financing comes from, because it's a backwater of the mining industry, which is a backwater of the investment industry that is, you know, we're talking about broader themes here, so not just talk about Cornwall for a second, but it's extremely difficult now to see how capital is going to be effectively deployed in the mining industry to build new projects. And why do I say that? I say that because the vast majority of funds that are out there have been out of commodities since about 2010, you know, to a large extent. I think the median fund in the world's allocation to commodities is still zero. And they don't have the expertise. And these people that they require to effectively deploy capital in a rational way simply don't exist. The fund industry globally would need to hire thousands, tens of thousands of geologists or mining engineers or financial market experienced mining investors in order to deploy capital into the mid to lower tiers of the mining industry. And these people don't exist. They don't exist for the mining companies, let alone for the financial institutions that need to invest in them. So this is a serious headwind to work out what the transmission mechanism is from higher prices generating renewed interest from investment into how to actually effectively deploy that capital. It's one of the headwinds I just see stopping mines getting built. You know, you can talk about the other headwinds being things like regulatory situations, increased royalty rates and taxes as prices go up. And it's just basically creating an environment where building new mines is extremely difficult.
Do you think that that means that more and more mining will be done by, let's say, countries and cultures other than the Western cultures, such as China and perhaps even, I hesitate to say India, but some of these other major, Brazil perhaps could become a more dominant force in the mining industry alongside China, and potentially some of the Southern African nations might move ahead in a fair wind.
Well, look, China's 20, 30, 40 years ahead of the West in terms of its foreign policy, incorporating access to raw materials. Breaking into that is going to take hundreds of billions of dollars and political will, which I don't think exists. We need the crisis before anything gets done about it, but politicians won't understand there's a 20-year lead time on sorting this stuff out, so that's not going to happen. The extreme interest to me right now is the Middle East and the amount of capital they are deploying, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to secure. They're looking for a post-hydrocarbon world, and they want to be involved in the industries which are going to provide the raw materials which will replace hydrocarbons. So that's a source of capital. I have no doubt they'll make some bad investments, but, you know, and the way that those that area of the world likes to deploy capital is in tens of billions of dollar clips. So I see them more as an M&A buying into existing businesses rather than going out and funding much grassroots exploration and mine development. Yes, of course, Brazil will ramp up and et cetera. And I think, you know, existing jurisdictions like Canada and Australia need to have a serious look at their regulatory regime, the time to permit new mines, taxation regimes, et cetera. The market will find a solution. And maybe the solution is permanently higher metal prices and lower global industrial growth. Or maybe the solution is some sensible policies which allow us to produce more of the materials that we need to provide the materials for the green energy transition. Time will tell, but there will be plenty of opportunities for smart people to find ways ways to make money in that process.
I mean, it just seems that mining as an industry is culturally out of favor, speaking very broadly and generally, and that issues like ESG have sort of come down to kind of dovetail with that cultural unfashionability, and that although the mining companies need to do absolutely everything they can in terms of ESG, actually the fact that ESG has become such a big deal is really a sign that the culture is no longer supportive of this industry in the way it was 100 years ago or even perhaps 50 years ago.
Well, there's no doubt that society doesn't value mines or jobs in mining the way they used to be back in industrialization periods. And I think perceptions of mining still exist of it being a dirty and unsafe industry, which is very much not the truth these days. I mean, if you look at, the big players, incredibly safety oriented because they understand the cost of an accident, they understand the cost of a death, and really fantastic places to work. The problem is transmitting that then into the youth of today to generate the skills that we need to produce the materials of tomorrow. And, you know, you look at things like the Camborne School of Mine. They don't offer an undergraduate mining engineering degree anymore, not because they don't want to offer it, but because they don't have the uptake of sufficiently qualified, 2A, 3A students applying. My daughter's about to go and study mining engineering, and I'm no doubt that salaries for that are going to go through the roof because we need more mines. You know, there's not enough geologists, metallurgists, mining engineers, mineralogists, construction engineer. It's just these people don't exist, and it's going to take a generation to retrain them. And it's going to take a generation to retrain them in a circumstance where there's not enough people. So the people you would want training them are going to be earning the mega bucks, meeting the requirements of existing mines. And we need so many more than in the past because, if you took the example, BHP wants to add 1 million tons of copper to their portfolio. So, well, at the moment, first choice is you buy Anglo-American. Second choice is you go and find another 1 million ton a year copper mine like an Escondida or a Chuquicamata or a Grasberg. Well, I think they've all been found. So realistically, their only option is to build 10 to 20, 50 to 100,000 ton a year mines. Well, good luck finding 50 to 20, 100,000 ton a year producing projects which are shovel ready right now because we haven't been investing in those junior exploration companies for 15 years. So it's basically impossible. But the point being that the next generation of mines are smaller, they're harder to build, generally with worse metallurgy on higher costs. So we need more people. You know, an Escondida needs one chief geologist for 1 million tons a year. 20 smaller mines need 20 chief geologists for the same tonnage. So at the same time as we've got a load of people retiring and we're transitioning to smaller mines, we need vastly more skilled professionals in the mining industry. And these people do not exist. But and are not going to exist anytime soon.
In that sort of complex and difficult scenario, you still retain your former statement that the market will find a way.
The market will balance by definition. And to come to the point, interesting on tin is we're pretty close to the point where there can't be a deficit in tin, which sounds counterintuitive when I'm talking about production staying static or going up a little bit and demand going through the roof. And the reason for that is a deficit is the difference between supply and demand plus the change in inventory. And we're pretty close to the point where inventories are zero. And at that point, they can't change. They can't go any more. They can't go negative. So supply equals demand. At that point, you have to ask yourself, what price? The only thing that can give then when demand, when inventory can't change is price. So you're asking, at what point does the tin market balance? You know, so, you know, this is, you know, as a perfect storm, you wait a lifetime. This is the scenario we're in. And it's not just tin. Uranium, oh my God, the deficit in uranium. The amount of nuclear reactors that are getting built, with all of which are 2 to 3 times the size of the ones that are coming offline. You know, no one's talking about how we're going to fuel these things. I said, oh, there's above ground stock and recycling and blah, blah, blah. Yes, there's 5 years of above ground demand for uranium, but the countries that have got it aren't going to share. I would be livid if we shared our uranium with new entrant countries, given the outlook for uranium price. The industry's been so used to it being 2 to 5% of the input cost. What are they going to do when it's 50% of the input cost for running a nuclear reactor? When you've committed tens of billions of dollars to a new reactor. It's stupid. I've had these conversations with government in the UK and the US, and it's head in the sand time. They just simply don't understand the issues, let alone have a plan to how to deal with it. So fine, great. You know, the inevitable is going to happen. Uranium's going to get a $200, $500 a pound in the next, you know, 5-10 years. And there'll be a lot of nuclear reactors that can't operate because there won't be any uranium. Fine. It's what it's going to be. The market will find a solution because that which can't happen, can't happen.
Do you see the Kazakhs playing a similar role in uranium as the Indonesians play in tin? Is that a reasonable analogy to make, or is there a significant difference?
I think you come to the point on all of these things when you get these mega deficits that politics basically intrudes and it becomes a bigger issue and a bigger discussion. I mean, from an economic perspective, the smart thing to do is to sell half as much at 5 times the price.
Yeah.
10 times the price. Now, obviously, that then becomes a politically sensitive, and not sensitive, and it just becomes an absolute nightmare for consuming countries to go and have those conversations with their suppliers. So I wouldn't want to predict what's going to happen, but there's certainly, you know, the influence that the Middle East has had is going to get spread. Yeah, on oil will be the same in uranium, and the West is going to have to educate itself on where these materials come from and how to do something in an environment where China is 40 years ahead of us.
Yeah, it's going to be a long, long process. So what do you think about copper then? I mean, bringing it back to commodities specifically, that's another metal that's been in the news quite a lot lately and moving around for reasons which are both understandable and sometimes mysterious. What are your views on the copper market and where it's heading?
So I've been an uber bull on copper for a very long time, since it was 1360 at the bottom of the last cycle, very much for the same reasons as tin. We've just basically the easy to mine high grade stuff has gone. You know, the oxide caps, the high grade oxide caps have gone. You know, the future of copper mining is 0.3 to 0.5 porphyries in South America. These are multi-billion dollar projects. In an environment where a lot of places that these deposits are not really set up for the hundreds of billions of dollars of capital that needs to go in, I'm worried about Chile and their royalty and taxation regime, political stability in other places. I think there are other jurisdictions which can open up. I think, you know, Colombia and Ecuador are potentially future large mining regions, but they have their own security considerations. Brazil certainly should have more mines coming. But look, on the overall copper situation, there's a lot of metal around right now, and there's a lot of people confused as to how the copper price has gone from 8,000 to 10,600. And the reality is, even though there's a surplus of metal right now, and there's metal around, copper's in a deficit. and it's a deficit that expresses itself in the concentrate supply chain. So from smelter to consumer, there's probably still a small surplus of copper because the Chinese are buying less because the housing industry is very slowed down because of the property problem. But from mine to consumer, I've got copper in about a million ton deficit this year. So all of that deficit has been hidden in drawing down concentrate stocks between mines and smelters. And that's manifested itself in some totally bizarre concentrate treatment charges terms. So the way that smelters earn their revenue is they charge a treatment charge to the miners, which is an allowance for turning the 30% copper concentrate into 99.99% copper. And that's expressed as a TC and an RC. So treatment charges per ton of concentrate, and an RC is a refining charge per pound of copper to turn it from basically a blister into refined copper. And historically, the break even for the smelting industry is around 60 and 6, so $60 a ton and 60 and 6 cents a pound. And we've seen the low trade, not on a small tonnage for 50,000 tons, at minus 18, minus 1.8, which is so smelters taking a massive, massive loss just in order to get tonnages, which they hope they can make up on higher prices or higher metal premiums or byproducts of gold and silver content or making sulfuric acid or whatever else the revenue stream is. And traders who are short having to buy just to cover the hole that they have because they don't have the option of sitting and waiting. If they've got a short and an obligation to deliver, they have to buy back at whatever prices are available. I can't begin to tell you how shocking that number is. It is off the charts, unbelievable. I mean, last cycle we saw it down, I think a small trader, you know, just sub $10, you know, maybe a small print at zero. But to see it at minus 18, minus 1.8 is just staggering. And it's not just copper, it's lead, it's zinc, it's tin, it's everything. The supply chain is empty and we're entering that concentrate supply chain. And once that's gone, then the metal supply drops. The metal supply will drop 3 or 4% by the end of the year. And then you're into the moment. And you know, a lot of people keep saying in a pining world, copper can't go up because there's no short. There is a short. There's a massive short, but it's not an obvious short. The short in copper is incremental demand. So we're a 25 million ton a year market growing at 4% a year, 3.5%, 4% a year. That is the short, because there's no metal to fill that incremental demand of a million tons a year growth. We're talking about an Escondida a year every year. We're talking about two Escondidas a year in 17 years' time. Well, where are they? Which is 20, 100,000, you know, 50,000 ton a year mines or 10,000, 100,000 ton a year mines. Show me the projects. Show me the capital that's going to build these things. You know, show me the existing mines that aren't going to run out of ore eventually. So we need a new price paradigm. We need a new allocation of capital to build the future mines for the market abundance. Or we sit back and we get used to $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 copper in a couple of years' time, which I think is going to happen anyway before we start seeing the allocation of metal to it. So, yeah, fantastic opportunity to be long. The other point I'll make about prices as well, which I think is really important to understand, is it's almost impossible on a portfolio of exploration assets to make a profit at current prices. And that never used to be the case, because your discovery cost of copper used to be a fraction of a percent of the copper price, because you found it at surface, you drill a few holes, bang, I've got resources there. Now, if you take a scenario where the vast majority, if not all of those easy to find copper resources in the world have been found, because we've pretty much scoured the Earth's surface on foot and by satellite, future copper deposits are going to be undercover or hidden or need a much higher discovery cost, or they're going to drill out and not turn out to be a mineable ore body because they're not at surface. You can't really, you know, prioritize which things to drill and which things not to drill. So I estimate that the discovery cost on most metals these days is somewhere, depending on that, between 1% and 5% of the in-situ value. But you're still in a situation where maybe 1 in 20, 1 in 100, pick a number, of discoveries actually becomes a mine, because by the time you've drilled it out, does it hang together as an ore body? Is it consistent? Is there sufficient tons? Is there sufficient grade? Is there water? Is the mineralogy right? Is the metallurgy right? All those considerations. So how do you make a return on capital? The answer is you can't. So you need a higher price to justify exploration spend. And then you're looking at massive profits for existing miners, which attracts more taxation from countries which want more revenue, which again disincentivizes further exploration. So I don't know how this is going to play out, but again, it's just a massive headwind for how to allocate capital into the sector from funds who don't have anybody who have the experience to allocate capital into the sector. I'm paraphrasing here as well. There are obviously some very smart funds that do this, but they aren't going to be given $100 billion to go and spend the sort of money that needs to be spent on exploration.
I mean, it's a very interesting picture you're painting here, Mark. It seems to some extent, or to some degrees, a paradoxical outlook for the mining sector. On the one hand, there's this sort of bullish or even extremely bullish aspect where the prices are just going to rocket, at least in some commodities. And then on the other hand, there's this whole swathe of associated difficulties which are causing the prices to go up in the first place. So it behoves the investor to be very careful and perhaps very expert exactly how they approach a market like this, where mining itself is so difficult and becoming more difficult to turn a profit in, even though you may see commodities prices soaring away and think, well, that's opportunity knocks. And what I suppose the sort of footnote comment to that might be, well, this is partly why ETFs have become so popular, because people just go straight into the even if it's only a paper product, they go straight into the metal exposure on their computer screens and bypass the mining industry completely.
Yeah, and that's exacerbating the problem, because if that capital is not available directly to the people who need that capital, you know, so if you've got a uranium ETF with 20 uranium miners in it, that's great for those 20 uranium miners because there'll be an arbitrage between them and the capital requirements they need. But if you're anybody else and you're not in that index, there's no transmission mechanism for that public money to go into the ground. So, yeah, again, and look, the market will find a way. We don't have to worry too much about it. The arbitrage will get closed eventually. If there's a profit to be made, the market will find a way to do it. But it, generally speaking, when you have these transitions from one paradigm to another, there's a dislocation in the market required to incentivize that to happen. And that's the point I think we're at right now, is I think we're going to see a dislocation in price in order for all the changes that need to be happened to secure future supply to happen. And it's going to take a few years. And in a scenario where it takes a few years, that dislocation in price could be extreme. So I like to tell people a statistic, because this is, again, very few people look at the history of markets. For the last 200 years on copper and tin, the average trough to peak move in a bull market is 6x in price. And you can argue we've started this copper market bull market at 8,000. So 6x of that is 48,000. I would strongly argue that there's extenuating circumstances in this bull market as well. And there's three things that really make this different. One is money's worth less every day because we've spent 15 years printing unlimited money to fund government deficits. And I don't see that process ending. So we're in an environment where I think the dollar is the world is de-dollarizing. So the dollar is going to be worth less over time. So on a nominal basis, 6x for a dollar-denominated commodity will probably be higher on this cycle. The second is we've never seen a bull market kick off with such new demand growth from a sector that didn't really exist before. And broadly speaking, I'll call that green energy transition. Okay, and so that's probably across the board adding 0.5% to 1.5% of additional demand per year. It might be higher in some metals, slightly lower in others. But that's an enormous, you know, 1% demand is enormous. These are markets that traditionally grow by 2.25%, 2.5% a year. So you're adding 50% to the growth rate. Mm. And the third, perhaps most pertinent factor is I'm not aware at any point in history where we've started a bull market with almost no inventory by historical comparisons in terms of days of demand. So you add those three things together and you say the average bull market is 6x. Well, what might this cycle be then? 8x, 10x, 20x. You know, we saw uranium do 27x last cycle. Is that going to be the new normal? It's going to be fascinating to watch. But I think this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You know, I mean, you can say that too much. It's a second in a lifetime opportunity on some metals. But it's a once in a generation opportunity, I think, right now, because it's just the perfect storm setup. there's difficult to see where the supply is coming from. The demand is there. On the flip side, what could blow up the thesis? I mean, obviously, global political tensions, much of which is related to raw materials, could really blow up the theory. But outside of that, and the only other place which I see is the reactions to this, which I spend quite a lot of my time working on. So I'm advising an AI company, visual AI company, so basically video AI. I mean, they've got some amazing technology. And using that to sweat existing assets better, to be safer, to increase productivity, to decrease downtime and unplanned maintenance, you know, see if we can't squeeze an extra, well, we're getting, you know, 5 to 10% additional production out of mines. That's the only thing, but that's a short-term, one-time sticking plaster, which will get rolled out in the next 5 years across the mining industry to sweat existing assets harder. But outside of that, I just struggle to see how we're going to build the number of, you know, permit the number of mines are needed, let alone find the money to build them or the people to build them.
So as a former fund manager and possibly a future fund manager as well, how would you balance a portfolio then? I mean, do you have any sort of general thoughts about what sort of mix you would put into any particular funds that you might construct?
I mean, I hate saying this, but I think it's the time to be reckless. I think concentration risk can be a virtue in these sort of markets, right, as opposed to diversification. So I'll bring it down to one of my favorite aphorisms that I have in the market is it's all about management. And particularly in this, when I talk about there's not enough good people to go around, is find the good people and back them. Yeah. Because good people don't get involved in bad assets. So find people who've got a track record. I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter which commodity you're in, you know, whether it's copper, tin, uranium, lead, zinc, whatever. You know, they're all going to go up. Everything's going to go up. Some will go up more, some will go up, and then they'll come down, and then you can be in something else. So I think it's beyond the wit of most average investors to time that. I think you are better off from a risk perspective finding teams who've done it before, who can build mines or who can run assets or who can just generate value, because that is the safe thing to do here.
So find people you trust and you think are going to make a good job of the work and let them get on with it.
Yeah, because at some point in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to be back to the point we were in 2005, where any old shyster with 10,000 acres and a theory could raise $10 million off a $20 million pre-money valuation. Those times are coming back, and that money will all be bunked up the wall on champagne and hookers like it was on the last cycle and private jets. And that's, again, a reason why fund managers just don't want to be in this space right now. Is because they remember, you know, they saw their boss in 2009, 2010 sacked because of the money you deployed in 05, 06, 07 and it all disappeared. So, just find good people, back them, and you'll do well.
That's interesting. So you think those lessons are still with us? Because some people argue that memories are actually quite short in the market. You know, you see some mining companies going out and doing or at least contemplating big deals that, in the manner of the 06, 07 boom, wiped out a huge amount of value, and they could do that again. So some people's memories are not that good, but you're saying that you do see some people who do remember and have learned from that experience of that previous boom.
You know, today's 40-year-old fund manager managing $1 billion was the 25-year-old coffee boy watching his boss get sacked 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yes, I do think there are institutional memories on these things. And I do think it's extremely hard to deploy capital efficiently in the mining industry. It is a real expertise required. And even if you do it absolutely brilliantly, you can still get blindsided on environmental regulation or permitting, or the mineralogy wasn't right or whatever. You know, there's 1,000 things that absolutely perfectly designed projects can still go wrong on and have done historically, you know. So it's extremely difficult to deploy capital well. That said, the market, you know, the cost of capital these days for a mine, you know, just on debt is 21-22%. So the market's found a level where, you know, last cycle where debt was available, you know, 7-8%. Now it's now 21-22%. So that covers the spectrum. You know, I think it's more realistically priced. You know, anyone who puts out an NPV5 on their project, run a mile, even NPV8. You know, I do calculations on, you know, NPV12 as my base case, and just to give you an idea. And if you're not getting you know, these projects don't exist, but you know, I want to do an MPV 12 and see an MPV twice the capital expenditure. Good luck finding many of those, which again comes back to why prices have to go up, because roughly speaking, if an MPV 12 are making double your money is your benchmark for putting money in, the question is, what does the underlying price assumption have to be to get there? And that gives you an idea of where I think underlying prices should go to. So you're coming at it from a different perspective in terms of a risk on capital valuation. And again, you come out that $10,000 copper is too low, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because it just these numbers just don't work as you follow from exploration through to construction and operation and making a return on every single part on average across multiple projects of that supply chain, prices have to be higher.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting period that's ahead of us. So, I mean, it's been very interesting talking to you this morning, Mark. Have you, before we wrap it up, have you got sort of any final thoughts you'd like to leave the viewers and listeners with, or have we covered it all off, do you think?
No, I mean, we're still at a stage where we, you know, you've probably got 15 people watching this, you know, and 2 years from now, you'll have 15 million people watching this, and we'll look like geniuses. But
you will, I won't.
It's just the start, you know. I mean, just that, you know, this is here for a decade or longer. So, you know, you don't have to jump in two-footed just now. As I say, find good management teams, find things you understand, educate yourself. The resource on Twitter of expertise in individual areas is quite significant these days. It's something that's never existed before. And I find myself learning things on commodities that I didn't know about, or projects I don't know about, people who've got big positions for them. It's a fantastic resource, but you know, I think that's amazing for small investors that actually you don't just have to rely on a broker and take the word of a CEO anymore. You've got actually other ways of interrogating whether a thing is a good investment or not.
Do you post on Twitter yourself?
I have about 11,000 followers, and I limit myself really to talking about market generic things, and occasionally I'll talk about what investments I have. I personally have an extremely concentrated portfolio in a way that I would be uncomfortable as a professional, but as an individual is, you know, I like the recklessness of it. So,
well, I think people might be interested to know your Twitter handle, if you can remember it.
It's at ME Thompson 72.
Great. Okay. Well, I think I may add a total of one follower to your follower account today, and I'll be watching with interest. So thanks very much for your time today, Mark. Really appreciate it. It was a fascinating conversation, and you know, good luck in the future with all your endeavors, and hopefully in the optimistic aspects of our conversation, you'll be proved right and the negatives won't be too negative.
Well, if I'm wrong, people will forget, and it wouldn't matter anyway because there aren't many people watching yet in metals, but you know, so but I, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and you know, there's never 100%. But for me right now, you know, this is a 95.5 trade, and I never get to 95.5 on anything. This is as sure to happen as anything that I've ever seen in history. I say subject to an exogenous shock such as a World War III or something, but I just don't see how the markets balance.
Right. Well, we'll watch with interest, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for the right result.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you too, Mark. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.